Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. It's nice to see everybody here this morning. My name is Patty Walker, and I'm this morning's representative from the church board. We have a variety of announcements. There will be a short meeting of the Green Sanctuary Committee at 11:45 today. See Jerry Flakus if you have any questions about that. Next week, the 3rd to 5th grade RE class will be selling popcorn during the social hour to raise money for the Humane Animal Welfare Society of Waukesha, 50 cents a bag. We shall be having a very special Sunday on February 14th, celebrating Valentine's Day with the following lineup. 1, Jane's Sermon on Strength of Heart. 2, a special buffet brunch directly following the sermon, and 3, a very special speaker, first in our brand new LCUUC lecture series. Famed filmmaker Chip Duncan will speak on his travels and experiences in Haiti, Darfur, and the Middle East at 12:30 in the sanctuary. A book signing of his new book, Enough to Go Around, will happen as well. And speaking of enough to go around, please sign up for the potluck brunch today in the social hall. Let's see. I invite you to greet those sitting around you. If you are a visitor, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table in the foyer. There is a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after service if you have any questions about our church. If you've been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member, I'd be happy to talk to you about that as well. If you are visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to the religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right and across the entryway if there's a need for childcare during the service. If there are any visitors who are comfortable introducing themselves, now would be a good time so we could warmly welcome you.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Russell, and I'm Grace's dad.
Welcome. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Please put your cell phones on silent mode during the service. I hope you find this morning's service fulfilling. Our speaker today is Dr. Bobbi Groth. She's a UU community minister who focuses on victims and perpetrators of violence. She teaches sociology at Alverno College and sits on the executive committee of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, representing Southeast Wisconsin UU congregations. She is the author of many articles and has a book forthcoming from Skinner House Press about the Unitarian involvement in the Civil War in the Kansas Territory. She is married to fellow UU Don Lawson, has 4 grown children and 1 grandchild. Thank you.
remember their faces. We strive to continue what they strive to gain. Peace in our hearts, peace in our hands, peace in our lives, peace in our lands. Peace unto you, peace unto me, peace unto all the world's family. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome
Our opening words this morning come from the big book of peace. And I think you can see from the cover who this is meant for, besides people like me. It is Marilyn Sachs' I Was There. And this little poem, the pictures are just priceless. In this first one, we see a little girl in a stroller, a tree with an X on it, some foresters here, and a sign that says, "Don't you dare." When they tried to take down the big trees in the park, I was there. I sat in my stroller and ate a pretzel. The trees stayed up. When the public library gave a big party to raise money for a new building, I was there. My brother read me a story about a little bear. They're building a new library right now. When Charles T. Morrison ran for mayor, some people worked down at his campaign headquarters to help get him elected. I stuffed envelopes. I is getting older, as you can see. He didn't get elected. Maybe he will next time. And there's
our sad campaign flag in the trash can. When a war broke out, some people marched in a parade to protest. I was there. I carried a banner that said, "War isn't good for children." The war didn't stop, so then there was another parade, and another, and many, many others. I was at some of them. Sometimes I carried a banner, sometimes I sang songs, and sometimes I ate sandwiches. After a while, the war ended, and we had a picnic in the park to celebrate. And I was there. Huge crowd with a tiny dot. We light our chalice this morning for all of you, that you will be there, we will be there, we will all continue to be there. Please sing our chalice lighting song in the order of service. I'd like to invite the high school students who have volunteered to do our story for all ages today to come down. And any children, please, who would like to join us, come to the front, please.
Our story this morning is called If Peace Is. And since there's only three of you, you can come as close as you want to see the pictures. If peace is a candle, I'll light one each night. If peace is a hand, I will hold on so tight. If peace is a bell, I will make it ring. If peace is a song, I'll want to sing. If peace is a gift, I'll open it with care. If peace is a treasure, I will search everywhere. See the treasure map. If peace is a garden, I will tend every seed. If peace is a book, I'll have to read. But peace is more than all of these things, more than a book or a bell that rings. It's more than the work of just one or two. Peace is the work that we all must do. Peace is a promise we make one another. To love and protect and to care for each other. It's a hand waved in friendship, a smile on a face. A kind word and deed, any time, any place. Peace is a promise. It's something we do. For peace is a promise kept always by you. Thank you.
The offertory is a sacrament of the Free Church. It is supported by the voluntary generosity of all of us who join with us. The offering will now be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. And today, as in last week, there's a special collection for the UU Service Committee for their efforts in the Haiti relief. So if you prefer to donate, for your donation to go to the UUSC for the Haiti relief effort, please note on the memo line on your check, Haiti, UUSC Haiti.
Well, as UUs, we're very fortunate. We have many sacred scriptures to choose from. Today, our scripture reading is from Mark Twain. It was a time of great and exalting excitement. The country was up in arms, the war was on, and every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating, the bands playing, the toy pistols popping, the bunched firecrackers hissing and spluttering. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened, panting, to patriot oratory which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts, and which they interrupted at briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, the tears running down their cheeks the while. Sunday morning came. The next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse, the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tremendous invocation. God, the all-terrible, thou who ordainest, thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could ever remember the like of it for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever-merciful and benign Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid, comfort, and encourage them in their patriotic work. Bless them, shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril. Bear them in his mighty hand, make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset. Help them to crush the foe. Grant to them and to their flag and country imperishable honor and glory. An aged stranger entered and moved with slow and noiseless step up the main aisle. His eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. With all eyes following him and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended to the preacher's side and stood there waiting. With shut lids, the preacher continued with his moving prayer, and at last finished it with the words, "Bless our arms, grant us the victory, O Lord our God, Father and protector of our land and flag." The stranger touched his arm and motioned him to step aside, which the startled minister did. During some moments, the stranger surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes, in which burned an uncanny light. Then in a deep voice he said, "I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God." The words smote the house with shock. "You have heard your pastor's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into the words the other part of it, the part which the pastor, and also you in your hearts, fervently prayed silently. You heard these words, 'Grant us the victory, O Lord our God.' When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow it, cannot help but follow it. Upon the listening spirit of God also fell the unspoken part of the prayer. He commandeth me to put it into words. Listen. O Lord our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them, with them in spirit. We also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste to their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with little children to wander unfriendly and wastes of their desolate lands in rags and hunger and thirst, sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter. Broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love, and who is the ever-faithful refuge and friend of all who are sore beset, and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. Ye have prayed it. If ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High awaits. It was believed afterwards that the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. We arise as you are able and join us in Hymn number 159, This Is My Song. On a typical Midwestern December's day, we stand flanked by row upon row of upright gravestones in the vast veterans cemetery of the old Milwaukee Civil War Soldiers' Home. There are fallen here from the Civil War, the First World War, the Second World War, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, from Afghanistan. My future daughter-in-law performs her officer's color guard duties with precision and grace, despite the fact that I know her feet and hands are freezing and her dress uniform's inadequate accessories. She helps me and my tiny granddaughter choose our wreaths, place them, and record the names of the troops whose graves we have honored. Tears come to my eyes when I write down the name of the young boy on whose grave my wreath goes. I can't help but tap into his mother's long-ago anguish. It occurs to me that however far we have come as human beings, we have made almost no progress in the ending of wars. My future daughter-in-law is an Army lifer. She's a veteran of Afghanistan. My nephew is one of the first to have parachuted into Iraq, an experience so shattering it has taken over 7 years for him to even begin to come back to a normal civilian life. My brother, an Air Force chaplain, retired this year on PTSD disability after spending the duration of the Iraq War processing the bodies of our troops when they were flown home to Dover Air Force Base. My cousin was an intelligence analyst in the Vietnam War. My father-in-law was in the Navy during the Korean conflict. In World War II, one uncle received posthumous Heroes Medals for attempts to save fellow soldiers when their unmarked POW ship was sunk by American friendly fire. He went down with the ship. Another uncle lived with nightmares of liberating the concentration camps until he died in his upper 70s. A third uncle lost both feet in the war, suffering shell shock so bad he and his wife had to give up their children so she could care for him. Eventually, she put him in a car and ran both of them into a tree to end their agonizing existence. In World War I, both my great-grandfather and his son served in the same Army unit. One was a soldier, the other a chaplain. My other grandfather served in the Spanish-American War. My great-great-grandfather was a chaplain in the Civil War. His father served in the War of 1812. His uncle fought in the Revolutionary War, and that uncle's father in the French and Indian Wars. Despite being able to trace our military participation back that far, we do not consider ourselves a military family. I believe we are a typical American family, and most typical American families have been gravely touched by war. Alongside those in uniform were those who protested the wars or took their sons and fled to Canada to avoid the draft. What I learned above all from my family in the military, from watching them and listening to them, from their letters, descriptions of military service, family stories about them, what I've learned is that war changes its warriors, and those warriors and those changes to them are devastating. Dr. Edward Tick, whose book provided the title for this sermon, is a clinical psychologist who has spent his career diagnosing and treating PTSD of combat veterans. To him, war is a horror that inhabits veterans' bodies for a lifetime. After war, Tick says, we are different forever. We can neither get the old self back nor return to a state of innocence. Last week, the country celebrated the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., our national civil rights hero. Unknown to many, in 1965, he began to express doubts about the U.S. role in the Vietnam War. In April 1967, he gave a speech calling that war into question and criticizing the U.S. as the greatest global perpetrator of violence. King publicly, and with all the strength and power of his civil rights leadership, called on this country to break silence on the Vietnam War and find another method besides war with which to deal with the world. I'm as deeply concerned, he said, about our own troops there as anything else, for it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death. For they must know, after a short period there, that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. The more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. With those dangerous words, King shone a light on an economy that, despite the warnings of President Eisenhower, had come into the grips of a military industrialism using the working poor of America as fodder, and promoting the rightness and goodness of active combat as a protection from communism. In fact, what it was advocating for was a war to consume munitions in order to spur profits. I submit to you that this speech, more than any of his work for civil rights, was the reason for King's assassination. 1 year later to the day, he was murdered. No amount of suppression of documents or denial can erase the persistent evidence that governmental forces were at play in that assassination. King's primary work in civil rights served to spur on a progressive movement that went back to the 1700s in this country. His words against the war, however, were fanning the flames of a new revolution against the military-industrial economy and citizens' unquestioning obedience to the government that stood behind it. This made him an important target for the national security campaign against threats of communism. For his speech, King bore the ire of the press and mainstream America and the horror and disapproval of his compatriots in civil rights. He said, I have worked too long and too hard to get rid of segregation in public accommodations to turn back to the point of segregating my moral concern. Justice is indivisible. Justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And wherever I see injustice, I'm going to take a stand against it, whether it's in Mississippi or in Vietnam. King exposed in painful public detail what the U.S. was doing to the land and people of Vietnam and declared that this war revealed a rupture in the American soul where we were living out an evil as deep and destructive as Nazi Germany. He felt that Americans had a faith imperative to seek to end all wars. King said, a nation that continues year after year to spend more on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Now, I had a childhood amongst people who experienced Hitler's evil firsthand. That would tempt me to accept the premise that some wars are just. But I was never able to lay aside two very troubling observations. First, training to participate in war takes a human being who instinctually recoils at killing another human being and embarks on a sustained abuse of their minds and bodies to get them to a point where they are able to sever the soul-psyche connection long enough to take another human's life. If that process is a necessary and routine preparation for soldiering, then how can justice ever come of it? Secondly, if the main casualties of war are among the innocent, the non-political, the helpless, the ordinary citizens like you and me, the children, how can such large-scale threat and control and killing be good or generate good by any stretch of the imagination, either for the actors or the acted upon? The evidence that war has become the largest industry of the U.S. economy is irrefutable. The inexorable quality of the way our country has marched towards it in every generation is staggering and grisly. The sickness of our culture is in our unwillingness to recognize any other solutions or responses except violent ones. Wars are never about moral or physical security or justice. What I call the investment opportunities presented by war always come first. Stakeholders in that opportunity manufacture a moral issue and enlist a few with money enough to give the argument media voice to persuade ordinary people that their security is threatened and that they engage in something worthy, just, and holy in going to war. The machinery that drives that war then enmeshes itself in the population right down to the jobs of the working people, the same class that generates the cannon fodder that is devoured by the war and the factory grunts who, without adequate wages or health care, make its weapons and enrich the military-industrial capitalists. When a sizable proportion of the population cannot earn its daily bread, lest it work for the industries and sub-industries of war, the control of warfare over that population is complete. At this point in our history, when we have just witnessed a progressive administration running on a promise to end one war, fold itself into further military aggression as an economic policy, the marriage between politics and a war economy seems insurmountable. But that does not make war inevitable. It just makes us that much more likely to ignore it and to ridicule those still protesting the war out on the street corners. We want to compartmentalize it and put it away in a box out of sight of our daily lives. The damage to our souls done by the necessity to survive in this way is only a matter of degree compared with the damage done to the souls of our troops as they carry out the war, quote-unquote, for us. That damage makes the troops capable of shooting bombs into buildings where they can hear children crying, capable of sexual and other acts of torture upon prisoners of war, capable of running over children with tanks because they might have incendiary devices strapped to them, capable of maiming and killing and rejoicing in those acts, capable of sexually assaulting the female troops in unprecedented numbers. And it makes us capable of tolerating it. We live in a damaged culture, and to live here without active protest is to nurture a damaged soul. We are all culpable for what our government does in our name with our taxes. Unless I am actively engaged in exposing the sacred cow of warfare and working to loose its grip on my country, my culpability is immoral. Every day that I don't work for something else, whether it be standing on street corners with signs, writing letters, phone calling, persuading young people away from military recruiters, any of the actions I can take, unless I am doing those things, I am complicitous in the deaths of the young men and women in our military and the deaths of those who die because of our military. Dr. Edward Tick raises a very profound to me question. He says, what if PTSD is a national disorder that the individual carries? What if PTSD perpetuates the circumstance of lost souls imprisoned in their private terror while allowing the rest of us, along with our leaders, to perpetuate the public fantasy of our own innocence? Tick has amassed evidence from hundreds of veterans to show that PTSD is not simply battle exhaustion or amenable to eradication with medication. It is an indication of injury to the soul, the very heart of the individual's being. You don't have to be a Christian or even religious to understand what Tick means by the soul. He says PTSD is an expression of the anguish, dislocation, and rage of the self as it attempts to cope with its devastating loss of innocence, reformulate a new personal identity and cultural role, and awaken from massive denial. Veterans with PTSD are people whose belief systems have been shattered. The basis of that shattering is that the archetypal role warfare played in traditional societies has been eradicated, because modern wars are a massive exercise in technology-driven slaughter, wholesale to the point of meaninglessness. Weaponry is so sophisticated that it destroys both society's infrastructure and the environment right along with human life. There's no opportunity for today's soldier to be a hero. Rather, they are minuscule globules of armed protoplasm hurled at enemies in uncountable numbers. Survival is now reduced to an accident in the midst of global carnage. It is laden with a sense of unworthiness and guilt. Contemporary military personnel are in wars for very uncompelling reasons, because they were forced to join, because they were poor or unemployed, because they have been socialized or brainwashed to vague ideals or amorphous fears. Our food supplies and families have not been bodily threatened. Despite propaganda about homeland security, large portions of the population can see that for themselves. Without a demonstrable justice to fight for, and with the capability of wholesale slaughter from modern weapons, combat brings troops face to face with a painful and devastating betrayal of their innermost moral codes. They are made capable of killing in basic training. However, all but the already sociopathic are not made capable of ignoring the emotional repercussions of that killing. Tick observes afterwards they pass through life without feeling, like wooden puppets on a string. They ask, how could I do right in that impossible situation? Ultimately, am I good or bad? These questions characterize the lifelong confusion, loss of motivation, the sense of not belonging that follow veterans for decades. The questions express the profound degree of dirtiness, stain, and inner tainting that throughout history has been associated with evil. The survivors then ask, have I done good or evil? If I've done evil, then what am I? Some of the first casualties in Iraq of female troops were later revealed to be suicides. They could not bring themselves to carry out the orders to destroy children and innocent civilians. Wars based on false political pretenses soon dash the souls of the troops into a moral abyss. Soldiers report that your soul feels banished from the divine presence. You feel cut off from the source of life itself, condemned to the dark place where there is no life. This causes a horrendous fracture to the soul. He was in Nam. When that is said to explain a person's odd behavior, it is enough said. I know vets who are still hiding themselves emotionally and sometimes physically from their families or the outside world. They are unable to tolerate normal everyday experiences, the smell of raw meat, loud sounds, crowds, certain foods, even a human touch. But as a national populace, we have tired of the reality of war. So many deaths make us feel helpless and apathetic. We change the radio or TV channel if it even comes on the news. We skip over it in the newspaper. Some of us rationalize that the violence is necessary for security or demonize our enemy as deserving to die. We turn our backs and hope it doesn't touch any of our loved ones. In order to engage in a war, those who promote it first dehumanize those who will participate in it, both those who will be killed and those who will do the killing. Our troops are dehumanized as part of their combat training. Our enemy is dehumanized by creating a propaganda campaign using words like shock and awe or collateral damage to talk about the monstrous slaughter we do to them. In the face of our war weariness and denial, Tick calls us to restore the moral vision of Faust. One person's suffering should truly be enough to make us doubt and stop. Now, the lives of the veterans Tick has treated show that healing does not come from forgetting or avoiding, but from remembering the dreadful combat and viewing it with what he calls the heart wide open to the pain. Experiencing the devastation to its fullest is how his veterans begin to process and to mend. It is only in the fullness of that pain that the soldiers begin to understand what is required of them to put right the atrocities they have participated in. They then begin to reconcile their deepest moral and spiritual convictions about the sacredness of life by turning an eye for an eye on its head. They go back to the lands and the scenes of their soul injury and give the old biblical law new meaning. Take an eye, return an eye. Bomb a school, build a school. Restore what we have taken, give it back. Give back life and a chance at a good life. One Memorial Day stands out for me above all others. It was during the earliest days of the Vietnam War. A young, recently returned veteran had been asked to address the crowd at our small town's Memorial Day parade. He stood straight and solemn in his uniform, and we all expected him to say something very patriotic. But when he took up the microphone, he said, "What's going on over there is wrong. We don't belong there. We're hurting innocent people. We need to stop this war." I don't remember his name, and I don't even know if he survived the war. I was only about 9 years old at the time. But he has lived on in my mind as one with the same courage that Martin Luther King had. They came out against the war in a time when it was dangerous to do so. King even faced the threat to his own life and lost. Can I be that brave? Can you? But we must be if we are to break our complicity in this madness. I am of inveterate anti-war beliefs. But I have not been able to paint the soldiers with the same condemning brush with which I paint the war and the war profiteers. Those soldiers are my family, and they have stories of why they got into the military that could have happened to me. I recognize that if war came across our borders and into my own home, I'm a pretty good shot, and I would die for my family. This realization holds a peculiar tensive place in my reality. It is the realization that I would do this that makes me understand both how individuals get drawn into wars and how indefensible are the wars of our enormous nation against the little peoples of third world countries. The infallible hook that draws people into soldiering is the belief that somehow they are preventing the war from coming home to their own families. It is only when they get to the combat zone that they realize they themselves are the war, and it is other people's innocent families they are violating. After all, the people they have been sent to kill are also pretty good shots, and they will die for their families when we invade them. We cannot look away. We are all liable for our country's wars. Even left-wingers, even progressives, even vegetarian, dirt-loving tree worshippers. Our private oases of green, healthy living or progressive thought will not end wars. We must be public and active. Good citizens are compelled to fight against the demonization of target groups. The greedy underpinnings of war must be discussed and broadcast, and the names of the war barons exposed and held up to public scrutiny. We must be on street corners. Above all, politicians must be held accountable for lives wasted and lost. We are the ones who must make them confront the pictures and stories of those who have been the casualties of war. We must force an open heart transformative experience into their gated, sheltered, and often greedy existence. Tick gives us one final compelling admonition with which to begin. He says, we must not deny or deaden our feelings about war. Rather, we must remember the war and its lessons. We must say our prayers for peace and remember the pain and losses war has caused us. We must learn to walk through hell with our hearts wide open. If we do not, we deaden ourselves while abandoning the victims, past and present, to hopeless suffering. I now invite your responses in our polylogue. Could you join me now? Rise as you are willing and able. Hymn number 276, O Young and Fearless Prophet.
Against unneeded wealth, for some go strong.
remain standing as you are able for our responsive reading number 573. Julia Ward Howe was actually a friend of my great-grandfather, the one who got me into my research on Bleeding Kansas in the pre-Civil War and then the Civil War Unitarian projects. And supposedly she actually wrote Battle Hymn of the Republic while staying overnight in his farmhouse. So I don't know if that's true. I was never able to pin that story down. That's the one my great-grandma told us, his daughter. But Julia Ward Howe was just a profound, profound anti-war mover and shaker. This is her Mother's Day proclamation. Arise then, women of this day. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies.
Our husbands shall not come to us to redeem the primary for the law.
Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm.
The sword of murder does not balance justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor.
As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as the means whereby the great human family can live in peace. The Universalist minister of my home church, Olympia Brown, said, "We can never make the world safe by fighting. Every nation must learn that the people of all nations are children of God and must share the wealth of the world. You may say this is impracticable, far away, can never be accomplished, but it is the work we are appointed to do. Sometime, somehow, somewhere, we must ever teach this great lesson. This service is ended. Your service has now begun. Go and teach this great lesson and do the work you are appointed to do."